discovering stories of courage, determination, and hope. Welcome to Faith Radio's On the Road. Now, here's Ryan Thomas.
Life is short, I want to live it well. One life, one story to tell. Life is short, I want to live it well. And you're the one I'm living for.
For years, Holly Burkhalter was a heartbroken idealist working on the front lines of change around the world. A witness to the brutalities of genocide, greed, and injustice. Throughout her career, she found herself angrily, sometimes hilariously, at odds with a God who seemed distant at best and tyrannical at worst. Until the day she found herself drawn into a community of fellow activists who loved, worshipped, and served another God altogether. A God who hated injustice too, and who had a plan for combating it. Us. In her book, Good God, Lousy World, and Me, The Improbable Journey of a Human Rights Activist from Unbelief to Faith, Holly engages deeply with the questions that kept her from faith for most of her adult life. How could a good God allow brutality, mental illness, and AIDS? And what is our part in pushing back the darkness? Holly is a leading international human rights advocate with a 30-year career in Washington, D.C. She worked in Congress and for several prominent human rights organizations before joining International Justice Mission, where today she serves as Senior Advisor for Justice System Transformation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ryan. I'm delighted to be here.
In your book, you open with this very arresting scene in West Africa where you're working to deliver aid in the midst of this unfolding tragedy. Could you paint the picture as we begin of where you were and why you were there?
That would have to be a really low point in the way I felt about God and about Christians and about the Bible. I was an atheist until about the age of 50. I'm 63 now. But I was in West Africa. I was with a group of refugee experts, and we were doing an assessment of conditions for Liberian refugees who had fled across the border into the Ivory Coast. This is in the early 1990s. It was after the president of the country had been murdered, and there was a huge killing spree going on in the country, and about 200,000 men, women, and children just up and fled very quickly into the borders of Guinea and the Ivory Coast, and they were in very difficult straits. But the local, very, very poor people, literally living in the jungle, just took them in, and we were out there to sort of assess what the situation was with what they needed, were the aid agencies reaching them, but also I was supposed to be collecting stories and anecdotes about why they had fled. I was supposed to do a sort of reconstruct a human rights report on Liberia. These were all Liberians who had fled their country. And frankly, I'm not an experienced field researcher. My work was always based in Washington, where I handled policy and writing and speaking and relations with Congress. I was not experienced about to go into the field and take testimony from victims. And it was very difficult to hear. And to this day, I cannot repeat some of the things that I heard that human beings could do to each other. I'd been in the human rights field a long time, but hearing it from the victims as they described seeing their relatives hacked to death, I did not have the emotional preparation for it. And I was traveling with some people I'm sure I would get along great with now, lovely folks, including this very, very faithful woman who was very, very religious. And as we left one of these tiny little encampments where people were just eating what little the villagers had for them, and I had just heard sickening stories, this woman was stopped to thank God for the fact that we had not had a flat tire, and I just about lost it. I'm thinking, I'm talking to people who lost absolutely everything, their kids, their siblings, their spouses.
Yeah.
And we are now going to thank God for the fact that we have four intact tires. And it sort of encapsulated for me rage on my part against a God who would allow such a thing to happen, rage at Christians who seemed so naive and so sort of self-absorbed. I don't think that at all now, but that was a low point for me. And I think every single one of us who have any goodwill at all have to wrestle with the same things I wrestle with. We all do. We should never, ever be comfortable with gross injustice and cruelty and the disparity of suffering. Never. We're not supposed to be comfortable with that. We're supposed to be agonized. We're supposed to be mad. But at the time, all I could really do was flail around and curse God, and I wasn't a very pleasant traveling companion, I'm sure.
Well, understandably so in that scenario. So paint some of the history, if you could, for us here when it comes to your spiritual life. What was your experience with God growing up, and how did it shape your view of him?
Well, I grew up very much in a Christian family, and our church was a huge part of our life. My grandparents, my dad's parents, were missionaries in India, and I loved them very much. They were in India from 1918 until 1955.
Wow.
Came back. They'd seen partition, independence, and they'd served amongst the poorest of the poor. I loved them. They were very influential in my life, particularly my grandmother. And I was raised just as a conventional, you know, Christian kid in the 1950s. We went to a Presbyterian church. My dad was was a professional musician, was the choir director, never missed a Sunday, sang in the kid choir, played in the bell choir, the whole deal, and never even gave it a thought. I think when you're in the 50s and early 60s, when there wasn't really an alternative to be
right.
a Christian. Everyone's Christian. You know,
right.
I don't think I knew a single Jewish person. I didn't know anyone who wasn't a Christian. It's just kind of taken for granted, like the air you breathe. But when I was about 16 years old, my grandfather died, and my beloved grandmother had a complete mental breakdown. And she, I saw her in this terrible, terrible distress, where she literally did have a psychic break over the suffering that she experienced from losing my grandpa. And I later learned that she had a lifetime of a mental illness that was episodic. I knew her as the strongest and sweetest and kindest and most God-fearing person I had ever known, but in the wake of my grandpa's death, she just completely went to pieces. And I heard her saying that God had abandoned her. And that's, frankly, I didn't need to make a deeper study of it. That did it for me.
Wow.
Here I'm seeing this person who I knew was as saint-like as anyone, the gentlest, best woman who devoted her whole life to God, who then didn't show up for her when she needed him the most. And she, really, things went really dark for her. For about a year, she was in a near catatonic depression. She eventually got well, and her faith came back as vibrantly and beautifully as it ever had been, but mine did not. That, to me, that kind of close-up experience of mental illness and not understanding where God was for her made me think, oh, heck, we just made the whole thing up, right? It's a fiction. We like to think it's real, but when the chips are down, it's not real.
Understood. No, that's beautifully said. Holly Burkhalter is with us, the Senior Advisor for Justice System Transformation at the International Justice Mission, and the author of Good God, Lousy World, and Me, The Improbable Journey of a Human Rights Activist from Unbelief to Faith. Now, relationships are at the key and sort of the pivot point of your story, and you describe a friendship that was especially pivotal in beginning to reshape your view of God. How did International Justice Mission's founder Gary Haugen come into your life, and what was it about this gentleman that began to make such an impact on you, Holly?
Oh my goodness, I just love remembering when I first met Gary Haugen. I was I'm a very liberal person, and I had a real chip on my shoulder about Christians because I assumed they were all super conservative. Since I didn't know any, I was a longtime human rights activist, and I was at my job at the time at Human Rights Watch, and a friend who's the chaplain at American University asked me if I'd meet this guy, Gary Haugen, who he liked, and he said, I think you'll find him interesting. I said, sure. So he said he's a Christian guy. He wants to start a human rights organization. This is in about 1996. So you know, I'm sitting in my office, and in walks Mr. Evangelical. Everybody should immediately run to their computers to get a picture of him. His hair today is exactly like his hair was in 1990. It was like sticking up in that butch crew cut evangelical hair, and you know, he looked like just well scrubbed, dark suit. And I could have thought, oh my gosh, this is just the archetypical evangelical. What I did think was, what a wonderful man. And he was completely captivating with his vision of what he wanted to do with his life. And he just gave me this very compelling picture of injustice and cruelty against the poor. I knew all about it, since that's my life's work. And he cared as much as I did. He also had just come off the field from doing an investigation for the United Nations into the Rwanda genocide. And there's nothing I cared about more than that. And here he had been out there literally amongst the bones and the skeletons piled up and did this investigation for the UN. He was the first boots on the ground after the killings stopped in June of 1994. And there's nobody that had a closer look at outrageous inhumanity and grotesque suffering than Gary, but his takeaway was very different than mine. Instead of asking, as I would, where was God, Gary's takeaway was, where were God's people? And he came back from the investigation with this firm conviction that he wanted to do something with his Christian faith, and he wanted to do something about violence. And he was here to just chat about that. And It was a riveting vision, and I do think, even though it took me about another 20 years to become a Christian, I will tell you that I think that Gary Haugen is at the beginning of that, because here I'm seeing a Christian who took the words of the Bible, and his takeaway from the Bible was God hates injustice. The Bible is full of scripture about it, and he wants his people to do something about it. And that's the part of the Bible I've never read. I wasn't familiar with it. You know, the justice gospel and the justice Old Testament as well were just not part of the conversation back at my church, very established church in the 1950s. And I'm not sure it would have reached my ears at that time anyway, but it sure did reach them in 1996. And it was thrilling to get to watch Gary be employee number one at International Justice Mission and gradually assemble around him this small little band of Christians who, animated by their faith, animated by the words of our Creator, they wanted to go literally one person at a time, try to protect people from violence and work with local authorities to bring people out of great, great suffering and bring justice for them in their cases. And I just had never heard anything like it. I worked in the human rights field, but nobody was teaming up with the police to go get tiny children out of a brothel. And their incredible passion for the one little girl, we can't save everyone, we're going to save this one, was very different than the way I had sort of been thinking about human rights policy, where you deal with great, great, great big numbers, but you never really think too much about the one. And it was really a wonderful experience to keep an eye on IJM and help a little bit out of my hip pocket, just a little bit, over the next considerable length of time. And Gary and I became good friends, and he introduced me to another IJMer who joined the staff when the organization was really still young and small. Her name is Sharon. Sharon Cohn at the time. Her married name is Sharon Cohn. Well, she and I became very good pals, and I really think between the two of them, not in terms of so much what they said, but just the way they acted and the way they were brave and they were funny and they were absolutely intent that God wanted them to do something about suffering on this earth. And that's just really kind of the beginning of my faith story.
That's beautiful stuff. Holly Burkhalter is with us, the author of Good God, Lousy World, and Me, The Improbable Journey of a Human Rights Activist from Unbelief to Faith. One of the most important and really the most arresting parts of the process that you describe in the book is coming to this realization that, as you expressed it, that the things that broke your heart, and you've given us, you know, just a brief window into some of the terrible things that you've seen internationally and the pain and the grief. But the things that you have seen, they broke God's heart far more than they broke yours. How did you come to that realization, and how did it change your belief system?
That's a hard question. I think when I was writing the book, I asked that question to a couple of my colleagues who I knew were probably the closest and had the closest witness to great, great suffering. I asked, and it was the guys who were investigating, our investigators who would go undercover and look for young minor girls in sexual exploitation. And they were wading into the deepest, darkest corners of terrible, terrible evil. And, you know, they would bring back information about the kids that they would find in the brothels, and they'd bring that information to law enforcement. And some of those girls they were able to go back and find, but not all of them. And the terribleness of actually having seen their little faces and not be able to know that they were safe. I just didn't see how they could bear it. And this is after I had come to faith myself, but I was still, and still am, very, very troubled by and upset by terrible suffering. And I asked one of our investigators, who's was a great, great friend and much beloved at IJM, and I can't tell you his name because we don't tell the names of our investigators.
Sure.
But I asked him, how can you possibly bear to go on? And this lovely, lovely man, former cop from the United States, just described to me how on each case that he was involved with, he would think about the girl that he had met when he was undercover. He would think about every aspect of her, every word that they had exchanged, and he would then, he told me, he would then just take that image of her and just lay it at the feet of Jesus. Mm. And what he made clear was that he knew that he was just a helper. You know, he's just Jesus' intern, right? that it was God's work to do, and that we wouldn't necessarily get to see the end of the story. But he so completely believed that there was a different story. And as he said to me, God had an eternity to make it right. And, you know, it is a matter of faith for me. It is a matter of being willing to and even happy to live with the mystery of there's something greater for all of us, and definitely for those that have suffered so terribly. There is something better for them. There's another story, whether we get to be part of writing it or not.
Oh, that's so encouraging. I'm from Holly Burkhalter here on the road. Ryan Thomas is my name. You know, we don't want to go any further without giving you a chance to talk really about your day job, because you're doing some incredible things with International Justice Mission. Give us a window. I mean, I know it's a big question, but a window into what your efforts look like from day to day as you work with IJM to battle against these modern day injustices.
Well, thanks for asking. It's every day is I get to witness and hear miracles, and I didn't even used to believe in miracles, and now I feel like I'm knee deep in them. You know, I'm in a support function, but as our most everyone here at headquarters, we're in we have 17 overseas offices in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and our staff are overwhelmingly nationals of their own countries. We have lawyers, we have investigators, many of them are former law enforcement from their own countries. We have a huge number of social workers who help with each client and help the victims of sexual assault or trafficking or slavery, help them get better. And what we do here at headquarters in the United States is support those teams. My particular work is, I'm a little bit of a jack of all trades now. I do writing and I do research and I do some work with the U.S. Congress, probably one of the most exciting things I've ever had the opportunity to work on in my career. It certainly isn't as dramatic as the work of my friends and brothers and sisters on the field, but in my world, which is policy land and Washington, D.C., it was a big thrill last year to watch Congress. That is to say, the Congress that, as you know, has been, it isn't well known for working together well, but God can work miracles, including in the U.S. Congress, and with the leadership of a wonderful anti-slavery leader named Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. All you Tennessee listeners, he is a fine, fine abolitionist, and he worked very, very hard to create a bipartisan anti-slavery bill, which the president signed into law in December. And the bill, which IJM helped support over about a 2.5-year effort, we had tens of thousands of IJM friends all around the United States in all 50 states. They paraded in, they wrote letters and postcards to their members and senators, they visited Washington, they had hundreds of meetings. They created the political space for members and senators across the political spectrum to really vote their conscience.
Wow.
The senator created a foundation that that received some U.S. Government money, but it's meant to be a blended fund so that it can also receive contributions from other governments and contributions from the private sector. In other words, there's kind of a burden-sharing aspect to it. The U.S. is the world's biggest donor to fight slavery, but that money is not near enough considering the largeness of the problem. So this fund is meant to basically take some of the learnings that IJM in particular has found, that when you enforce anti-slavery laws, when you rescue people and apprehend those who enslaved them and abused them, that crime can dry up. We've seen that in some of our field offices in Southeast Asia. We've seen that when police do their jobs and instead of protecting criminals, actually protect victims and go after the traffickers and the pimps and the brothel owners, start prosecuting people and putting them in jail, we can see that the prevalence, the numbers of children in prostitution, for example, forced prostitution, for example, can go way down. We saw 70% to 80% and more decrease in the availability of children for purchase in the sex industry in both Philippines and Cambodia. And that just shows that even in poor countries that have far from perfect human rights records, it is possible for police to professionalize, and it is possible to learn to do their jobs. Wow. And make a big difference. Well, Senator Corker was excited about that ray of hope and that model and wanted to see more resources put towards it. So he created this End Modern Slavery Initiative. And it's just now wobbling to its feet. It's just getting off the ground because the legislation was only just passed. But it was a thrill for me as a person who really believes in the United States' ability to do good in the world. It was absolutely thrilling to watch Republicans and Democrats get this thing done together and get it done well.
Mm. Wow. Well, and you said that you've witnessed a lot of miracles. You saw Democrats and Republicans in Congress working together. I'd say that's another one right there, huh?
You bet.
Holly Burkhalter has been with us today. What an amazing story. Just an absolutely tremendous story. Holly, thank you so much for your time. And before we let you go, if people are fascinated by the work of your organization, where can they go to learn more about International Justice Mission?
Oh, please come to our website, ijm.org. And while you're there, would you put on your search engine, ijm.org/Freedom Sunday. We have a wonderful project that involves lots and lots and lots of people in their church pews on September 24th. Hundreds of churches, many hundreds of churches, dedicate that Sunday to freedom. They have sermons. We sign up freedom partners who are donors to IJM towards our anti-slavery rescues. And it's just a pretty great thing. And that's something that everybody can participate in. So go to our website and look particularly for Freedom Sunday.
And we know the book as well is available in many fine bookstores around the country, but Good God, Lousy World, and Me. Do you have a place you recommend that people go to learn more and pick up a copy as well?
Probably the web. It came out in 13, so your best bet is probably something like Amazon. And do please buy thousands of copies. I got to put these two girls through college.
What a pleasure to talk with you today. Holly, thank you so much for your time and for the great work you're doing.
Thanks, Ryan. You too.
Thanks for sharing in the story of this latest episode of Faith Radio's On the Road. For more on today's conversation and the full podcast archive of all our episodes, look for On the Road when you visit myfaithradio.com.